Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Richard Barrett, Senior Vice President of the Sufan Group. That's a New York-based consultancy that provides strategic security intelligence services to governments and multinational organizations. We're coming to you from New York City. Richard Barrett is a former British diplomat and intelligence officer who used to head the UN monitoring team concerning Al-Qaeda and the Taliban from 2004 to 2013. While at the United Nations, Mr. Barrett helped found the UN Counterterrorism Implementation Task Force. He led the working groups on terrorist use of the Internet and on countering the appeal of terrorism. He was also known for his work on countering the financing of terrorism. We'll talk with Richard Barrett about the turmoil engulfing the Middle East, primarily the rise of ISIL, also known as the Islamic State, the presence of other extremist groups such as the Khorasan Group, the role of foreign fighters, and to what extent the multi-pronged strategy outlined by U.S. President Barack Obama to combat ISIL and the coalition he has assembled to do it will be effective. Richard Barrett, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
First, let me ask you about this strategy that President Obama outlined, in which the United States is leading a so-called coalition of the willing, a number of Gulf Arab states and European countries, to combat the Islamic State. There's obviously a combination of airstrikes, but there's also the political strategy. On the political side, Richard Barrett, do you think the Abadi government in Iraq, the new prime minister, is going to persuade Sunnis to back it fast enough to turn the tide while the airstrikes are trying to degrade the group on the ground?
I think that's a good question, in many ways a crucial question, because you really need the Iraqi government to be able to take advantage of the impact of the airstrikes as quickly as possible, because I think if the Sunni tribes who support the Islamic State don't feel that there's something out there to take the place of the Islamic State, which would be better than Nouri al-Maliki, the previous Iraqi government, offered, then they don't have very much incentive, as it were, to swap sides, because if they swap sides, they're putting themselves in the front line then against the Islamic State. And I'm sure they don't have very much confidence or even affection for the sort of Shiite-dominated army in Iraq, nor the Shia militia, who are playing probably the biggest role of all, really, in fighting the Islamic State on the behalf of the Iraqi government.
Do we have any evidence that that's taking place? Because we mostly hear about the airstrikes and the kinetic part of the strategy.
I'm sure that there's a lot of pressure on the Iraqi government from the United States and I hope regional powers as well to get going on these reforms. Otherwise, if it becomes more and more just the Americans coming in to hit local targets because people in the region will think this is in the American interest to do so to protect their investments in Erbil, in the Kurdish areas, then it doesn't really achieve what President Obama is after. So, yes, I'm sure there's a lot of pressure on Abadi to do something, but it'll be a very slow process at the best. So, again, I would agree with you that these things need to be synchronized rather better perhaps than they are.
And that leads us to talk about Syria, because not only is the United States and the coalition attacking ISIL in Iraq, but also Syria. These coalition strikes in Syria, we're hearing that they're disrupting command and control. But the question is, to what extent is this benefiting the murderous regime of Bashar al-Assad?
I think Assad has benefited definitely from the airstrikes, and I think in two ways. First of all, of course, the Syrian government narrative has always been that this is an assault on the government by terrorists. So the engagement of the United States and, you know, now up to 40 other states with the United States in fighting the Islamic State sort of, as it were, legitimizes that argument, that narrative. You know, it gives Assad some justification for claiming that these people are enemies to us all and not just to him. So I think he's certainly benefited in propaganda terms. And I think he's also benefited on the ground in operational terms, because the Islamic State is largely based in eastern Syria, where There's not very much going on, quite frankly. There's a little bit of oil, but the towns are small. There's huge areas of sort of desert. And it's not the heartland of Syria. The heartland of Syria, the line from Damascus to Aleppo and over to the west of that, which is where President Assad has his strength as well, hasn't really been so much of a target of the Islamic State. It's been more the al-Qaeda affiliate, Jabhat al-Nusra, and some of the Free Syrian Army groups that are operating there, which present much more of a threat to Assad. But although the Islamic State hasn't been so closely involved there, nonetheless, the Islamic State is opposed to the Syrian regime. It may not have exactly the same policy as the Free Syrian Army as to what to do after the Syrian regime is overthrown. But nonetheless, it is the strongest group in Syria that could be deployed, and to a certain extent has been deployed, against the Syrian regime. So the Free Syrian Army people, the rebels, would like to have that alongside them. And they don't really care whether they're al-Qaeda people, whether they're Islamic State people or whatever, so long as they can get their energy, their equipment, their material, their soldiers fighting against Assad. And I think that that was a trend that was happening now with the Islamic State moving towards Aleppo and so on, and being potentially a force to add to the rebel forces against Assad in Aleppo. So again, I think that Assad has benefited both in propaganda terms, in legitimizing his government, and in operational terms, in that a potential and even to a certain extent actual enemy to the regime is being weakened by these airstrikes.
Do you think that the coalition should also attack Assad as well, since he is not the alternative to ISIL, even though he likes to paint himself as such? And many would say that he, in fact, that is Bashar al-Assad, is the root of the problem, that he helped to, if not create, you know, exacerbate the threat from ISIL, that ISIL is, to some extent, a symptom of Assad and his tactics. He's not much better than the other autocrats who don't see, you know, some sort of a middle way. Again, you know, nobody's talking about that publicly, but how is it that you can do one and that the strategy could work without, in addition, trying to weaken his regime, his slaughtering machine?
I certainly agree that were it not for Assad's mismanagement of the government of Syria, then we wouldn't have had the protests in Daraa way back in March 2011, which then became violent as the year went on and then provided space for the rise of the Islamic State. But there are many, many reasons, I think, why it would be wrong to attack Assad. First of all, and most importantly, I think there's no legal basis on which to do that. You know, this is an internal affair. There's no Security Council resolution or anything else that authorizes force against Assad. And even the attack in Syria against the Islamic State is legally questionable. I mean, many people, including major states like, for example, Russia and China, would say, what is the legal justification for this? It's not self-defense necessarily, but I think the Americans would argue, well, it's all part of the war against al-Qaeda, and we are already authorized to do it. Beyond that, I think that if the American Air Force were to strike targets that were owned by the regime, you still then have the problem of, well, what's going to come in and take its place? There still hasn't been any sort of Geneva process which has led to a proper understanding of what future Syria would look like. I think second, also, the regime is really strongest in dense urban areas or dense suburban areas. So civilian casualties would be absolutely bound to mount. And that, again, then would be extremely controversial, I would have thought. And furthermore, just on the last point, I think that if you were to bomb the regime, you couldn't really make a real impact on it unless you put in ground troops. And that, of course, still remains for President Obama a real red line.
Back to then this concept of ground troops. The ground troops are supposed to be then members of the Free Syrian Army, the moderate opposition, are supposed to be trained in Saudi Arabia. Do you think that this strategy can work, Richard Barrett? The theory, and if so, what about ramping it up again quickly enough to make a difference? And we know, too, that these members of the opposition are not just going to want to help the coalition attack ISIL, but their ultimate aim, of course, is to degrade Assad in his regime if it is not then the objective of the coalition.
Yeah, arming and training the rebel is a difficult issue as well, in my view. You can say we're prepared to spend $500 million or something on this, and we've got facilities in Saudi Arabia to train and all that sort of thing. But you need the people. And what sort of people are you looking for? I think there's this tendency to draw a distinction between people who are moderates, in other words, people who might rule, govern, think of things in the way that many Western states do. And then there's extremists who we wouldn't want to be helping at all. And then there's Islamic State way over at the edge of that. But in fact, I don't think Syrians see it like that. To call a Syrian rebel a moderate is really using a sort of classification which he probably wouldn't understand. What they're all motivated by is the desire to get rid of Assad. And most of them think, what will we have after Assad? Well, we want something which is fair, which is inclusive, and so on. And it's probably going to be based to a certain extent on Sharia and things like that. Well, there, I think you immediately run into problems with Western sponsors who think, oh, well, if it's based on Sharia, does that mean it's going to be Salafist? You know, is it going to be a fiercely Islamic or Islamist type government? And if so, how is that going to play out, you know, in terms of regional stability and so on? Is that going to give rise to further sectarianism? How are they going to manage the multiplicity of belief and ethnic origin and so on that exists in that area? So I think that there will be a problem over the next months in trying to identify groups and particular leaders who are committed to seeing a Syria which would in many ways leave the region comfortable. And if you're to leave the region comfortable, you have all sorts of very different people to give comfort to. The Lebanese, of course, who are extraordinarily diverse in their own attitudes and rely on a sort of cobbled together government where everybody sort of understands that they have checks and balances to stop the whole place falling apart. You have Turkey, which is very strongly in support of a Muslim Brotherhood type approach to government. Then you have Saudi, which is obviously on very much the other end of that, not wanting anything like a Muslim Brotherhood type regime in Syria. Then you've got the Shia in Iraq. You've got the Shia in Iran, very concerned about having their linkage up through to Lebanon. So there's a huge amount of complications there. So it's all very well to say, okay, let's arm these rebels, get rid of Assad. But if you can't say we're doing that in order to implement this specific agreement, which has been reached by the regional players as well as the international players, then I think, again, you're not really necessarily solving the problem. You're just sort of making it different.
Right. Well, do you see that taking place, a discussion? Because I was under the impression that the rebels, if not quote-unquote moderate or perfectly secular, at least we know Syria has been and is a multicultural place. Assad actually tamped down on any kind of religious expression. So the impression I got was that many of these defectors from the Free Syrian Army were not necessarily Islamist in their orientation. There is a Muslim Brotherhood, but again, perhaps not as radical as perhaps in Egypt. I really thought that a lot of them were allying themselves with the more extremist groups for tactical reasons, which doesn't obviate the fact that there may be some who would like, you know, a more religious-oriented government. But again, whatever it is, one would think that our leaders are thinking about these next steps and are talking to these rebels, not only about how to arm and train them to fight ISIL and also perhaps Assad down the line, but to have them talk, reach out to current Assad supporters, Christians and others, Alawites, to say, look, you know, we intend to have a more inclusive government post-Assad. Again, you know, this seems to me something that statesmen should be engaging in, but we're not hearing it in the media.
Yeah, sure. And I'm sure they are engaging it. But it's a pity that the UN Arab League process, which had begun the dialogue between the opposition and the regime, or had attempted to, really has fallen apart. So there's no process really that involves Syrians as well as outsiders. Now, sure, the Baathism in Syria is a secular movement. Syria is a secular, tolerant state. And everybody wants it to remain like that. But when you're a rebel, when you're fighting against the Assad regime, but how are we different from those guys? And you have to have some sort of ideological glue. Baathism provided that way back, as it provided it in Iraq as well, way back. But that sort of secularism isn't, you know, the glue has dried out. It's not working anymore. So there has to be something else. And you can't just build a state on not wanting to be like Assad was. I think the rebels are very well motivated and they're committed to seeing change and everything, but they haven't really been able to think through the political consequences. For a start, I think the sectarianism won't really get sorted out until Saudi Arabia and Iran agree that they're going to stop trying to compete with one another in third countries, until everyone agrees that we need strong regional bodies, coalitions, like the Gulf Cooperation Council, things like that, but with real teeth with real interest in promoting trade, with promoting dialogue, promoting exchange of people and ideas and so on.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Richard Barrett. He's Senior Vice President of the Sufan Group. That's a New York-based consultancy firm that provides strategic security intelligence services to governments and multinational organizations. I'm Carol Castiel, coming to you from New York City at the headquarters of the Sufan Group. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And as always, we love to hear from you, so please send your feedback to PCUSA@voanews.com. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or keep up with me on Facebook. Here's a shout out to our faithful listener, Mary Chui Lechuga from Sinaloa, Mexico. Well, back to you, Richard Barrett. Let's turn now to one group that seems to have caught the attention of the United States and for which it seems to have precipitated the airstrikes in Syria, in addition to ISIL, or the Islamic State, as they're called. That is the Khorasan Group. They're supposed to be an al-Qaeda-linked organization, very lethal. What do you know about the Khorasan Group? And do you think they do pose even more of a threat than the Islamic State?
We have to go back to late 2011, early 2012, when the Islamic State in Iraq, as it then was, allowed these people to go over, and Mohammed al-Jilani and others, to go over to establish a group there in Syria. And at that time, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was in charge of all these guys, because they were all part of al-Qaeda at that time, saw Syria as the key opportunity for reviving the fortunes of al-Qaeda. And he sent over various senior people through 2012 and into 2013, who came from Afghan-Pakistan border area, they came from Yemen. Now, this group became known by the intelligence community, really, as the Khorasan Group, because when Jilani and Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State, fell out, Jilani said, we should go to ask Khorasan to mediate. And by Khorasan, they meant that geographical area, which is partly Pakistan, partly Afghanistan, into a little bit of Iran and so on, an old name for that part of the world. And that's where, of course, al-Qaeda Central was based. So because the guys who'd come over from the leadership were associated with Zawahiri, they were associated with Khorasan, they became known as the Khorasan Group. Now, they were slightly different from the Jabhat al-Nusra guys led by Jilani, because Jabhat al-Nusra was following al-Qaeda orders, which was to embed in the population, to gain popularity, to grow slowly, to focus on the local issue, and only when they were strong enough and well-established enough to look out to do other things elsewhere. Whereas the Khorasan Group were looking for more advantage that they could take from the situation in Syria. So given that Jabhat al-Nusra was attracting a lot of foreigners in there, they would look out and see whether some of them perhaps could be motivated to join the global agenda rather than just come to fight in Syria against Bashar al-Assad. And that's why it was thought that this group of sort of more experienced internationals, if you like, appointed by al-Qaeda Central, it was thought that they presented a greater threat because they would be much more focused on the international aspects, terrorist aspects, that are traditionally associated with al-Qaeda than the Jabhat al-Nusra local group, which was sort of feeling its way still. And because of the split between the Islamic State and Jabhat al-Nusra, Ayman al-Zawahiri had lost probably his most motivated and strongest group. And therefore, people reckon that he's bound to do something. And where would he do it from? Not from Afghanistan, Pakistan, because it's too difficult for them there. Not necessarily from al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is a good group, but one that's at the moment very tied up with what's going on in Yemen. Though they had shifted to this Khorasan group some of the bomb-making skills for which they're so well known. So looking around, everyone thought, well, they'll take that group in Syria and try and use that group to mount an attack against a Western target. And that's why it became a very important objective for the early airstrikes to try and knock out the leadership.
And have we been successful, as far as you know?
Well, it seems from sort of tweets of supporters that the leader, Mohsin al-Fadhli, may be killed. And that would be quite significant. But I doubt that the whole group of those sort of experienced al-Qaeda people has been dispersed by the airstrikes. So there may still be a danger there. But it's quite hard, I think, to quantify precisely what that danger would be.
Talking about the foreign fighters, I know you just completed a study. Talk about the ratio of foreign fighters, particularly in the Islamic State group. What is motivating them? Do you think we have the right strategy to try to deter this phenomenon?
Well, I should imagine that about a third, forces are foreign fighters, and most of those would be from Middle East, other Middle Eastern countries and North Africa. A particular role, for example, played by Tunisians, an awful lot of Tunisians there who are very loyal to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State, and do lots of the administration and stuff like that. There's also a load of Chechens there who are fighting quite strongly, both in Syria and in Iraq, but even more in Syria, in their own sort of ethnic groups, in their own battalions. And so the foreign fighters are really very important, but there are lots of different things which motivate them to go and join in the fight. And I think a lot of the times it's a very personal motivation. It's a lot of push factors, you know, that someone may feel alienated from society, not very happy with how his life's going, wanting a greater sense of purpose, perhaps a greater sense of identity as well. A lot of people may be second or third generation immigrants in the countries they come from, or they may feel that the politics of their country is not going in the way that they would like, and they're excluded from the future in a way, and they just want to sort of leave their past behind and start a new life. And the Islamic State offers a very attractive alternative for that. You come, you join us, we don't ask who you are or where you've been, we just want you to believe what we believe in and fight for freedom and justice and all these sorts of things. So the pull factors are there as well. And I think that when people get there, obviously they may be quite surprised to find how awful it is, but nonetheless, it is something that they can sort of reconcile. They can say, well, I don't have to take part in all the bad stuff. I can just do the good stuff, supporting the local community, fighting against Bashar al-Assad, fighting against the Shia, perhaps, if they see Shia as the enemy. And these guys, because really they have nothing to lose, you know, they're creating something new, are very highly motivated and very effective fighters. And particularly so, people like Chechens, who are quite often quite experienced fighters by the time they arrive, which is unlike those from Europe and North Africa generally. So these guys come together because they can't really do very much in Chechnya at the moment. The Emirate Kafkas, which is the sort of Chechen group, is relatively weak at the moment. And so they come over and they fight there thinking, well, we'll fight here, we'll carry on here until there's a good moment to go back and fight in Russia. So you get different groups, different motivations, different ideas, but all coming together and molded into this sort of Islamic State, which narrows them down by saying, okay, but this is what we believe in, this is our worldview and everything, and you have to conform with this. And slowly the conforming increases and the risks of leaving increase, so that the Islamic State army, if you like, is more and more focused on supporting the state and establishing the so-called caliphate.
Richard Barrett, I know your colleague Ali Sulfan has written extensively about combating the ideology of extremism. And here we are some 13 years after 9/11. And of course, he's arguing that we really haven't learned a lot, that the reasons for which some extremists continue to want to engage in violence in the name of religion or whatever, they're still doing that. And here we are 13 years later. What thoughts do you have with respect to combating this ideology of extremism? And what more should we be doing as the United States or the UN or other countries in a more forceful way to really get to the root of the problem?
It's such a difficult question. As you say, it's been going on for 13 years, and it's not for want of trying, I think, that extremism is still out there.
I apologize for interrupting, but of course, Ali Sulfan says, we have this counterterrorism approach, you know, sort of, okay, here we're going to blast the Islamic State group, you know, with airstrikes, which doesn't mean we're not going to try a political solution, but it's more this counterterrorism lens, and then we keep coming back to the root of the problem because we haven't really addressed it.
That's absolutely right, because counterterrorism is essentially a domestic policy issue. So even when you're bombing people a long way away, it's still a domestic response. I think in the United States, for example, people have absolutely zero tolerance for terrorism. Well, that's perhaps slightly unrealistic because terrorism, of course, is not just the Al-Qaeda type of terrorism. It's also from all sorts of different people. Some of them are deranged, but a lot of them are doing it because they really believe in something, but it's terrorism. So we're always going to have some, and we have to accept there's always going to be a very slight risk. Dealing with this sort of Al-Qaeda-related terrorism is very difficult because Al-Qaeda is such a broad body. This sort of particular narrative that your problems that you have, particularly as a Muslim, are all to do with the fact that you're a Muslim. Now, this is obviously not true. I mean, your problems are caused, you know, for all of us, many, many different factors. But because of that, they're able to put it in a religious focus, which I think provides the opportunity for extremism and makes it very much greater, particularly when education, religious education in some parts of the world tends towards that level of extremism. that it's not taught as the tolerant religion that Islam is. It's taught as this is right and that is wrong. So anybody who believes what is wrong is not only wrong, but an enemy, you know, somebody that you should take action against. That's a very, very dangerous way of educating people, to have this sort of black and white.
Are you alluding to the Saudis, the
Wahhabi doctrine? I think the Saudi education system is well recognized. It's got a bit better, but it's still well recognized to be a little bit of a problem. And the export of Wahhabism around the world has caused problems in other countries as well, because it's tended to provide the ground for this intolerance that Al-Qaeda and other groups like that can exploit. In itself, of course, it doesn't promote terrorism, but it allows other people to exploit it. And so I think that our countering violent extremism methodology should not be that short-term domestic response saying, okay, let's go and bomb them, because people don't appreciate that. And they think, why is this? This is an attack on us for what? So that's not a particularly effective measure, and nor is it a particularly effective measure if you allow this sort of intolerance of the other to carry on. And we see that all over the world, for example, in Boko Haram, which has now become an extremely violent and criminal group, which has attracted young people because they feel they don't have opportunity, but then also trapped people into the sort of ethos of the group by saying, oh yeah, this is religious, and if you do anything against the group, then you're doing it against your religion. But let's not forget that the people who lead all these groups, they're not interested in religion or anything else like that. They're interested in power, and that's what terrorism ultimately is all about, trying to gain power.
Richard Barrett is Senior Vice President of the Sufan Group. That's a strategic consultancy firm based in New York City. He used to work for the British intelligence service, the MI6. Richard, thanks so much for your time and terrific insights.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in New York City and Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Gary Jaffe. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.